Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and me, Petros Patsilivas. On this podcast, I shake every branch of the Coppola family tree to find out, are they the greatest film family of all time? The way I intend to do that is by watching every single film in their collective filmographies. On this week's episode, I had the pleasure of being joined by not only a great podcaster, not only Daryl Bear is the host of two of my absolute favourite podcasts. We'll get into what they are when I introduce Daryl in a second. But before we get into it, obviously we will be talking about this film in spoilerific detail. So if you haven't seen it, pause the podcast right now and go watch it. So I assume you're back, you've either watched it or you've already seen it, or you don't really care too much for spoilers. Unfortunately, this episode, there is no Patreon exclusive content. It's been hot, guys. I've been sweating out in the shed. And yeah, these episodes go on as they, enough as they are, I always feel bad about asking people to stay a little bit longer. But if you do want to support on Patreon, you can head on over there and it's patreon.com/cagedinpod. So all that's left to do is assemble your team, jump aboard the Pelham 123, and let's make some Coppola connections. ...1974 was a big year for the Coppola family. Francis released not one, but two films, with The Godfather Part 2, which features his younger sister, Talia Shire, and The Conversation, the latter scored by today's Coppola connection, David Shire, who also scored Killer Bee's Sidekicks that year, as well as the focus of today's chat, taking off the Pelham 123. To investigate what's going on the subway, I need my own Lieutenant Rico, to my Lieutenant Garber. I have the pleasure of being joined by one third of Sudden Double Deep and one half of his Paul Dano OK. Daryl Bear, how are you, Daryl?
Hello, mate. I'm good, thank you. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Before we get into talking about the Coppola family, tell us a little bit about the podcast you do. You've obviously, since we last talked, you've got a new one.
I know, right? Yeah, it's funny how that happens. So yeah, like first things first, Sudden Double Deep is the triple bill title podcast. On our show, we watch three films linked by a word in the title. We've been knocking around for about 5 years now. 5 years. Oh, that's mad. Recently, I don't know when this is coming out, but recently we recorded and we released our Earth triple bill. So I picked the word Earth out of the tin. And so we covered the 1959 Journey to the Center of the Earth, starring James Mason, The Man Who Fell to Earth, David Bowie, and then also the most recent Ben Wheatley joints, In the Earth. And then also on top of that, we've got mine and Matt's other podcast now, Is Paul Dano OK?, where we go through Paul Dano's entire filmography and just, we talk about the films and there's, it's mad because only about two thirds of his films have ever got a UK release as well. So there's some real hidden gems and hidden turds in there as well. And and we try and ascertain, is he all right? Is he okay? Is he doing okay?
You made the smart decision by doing like curated seasons and kind of like mixing some of the shit with some of the gold. Because one of the mistakes I made doing the Nick Cage stuff in chronological order is it's like front, like, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like when I'm still finding my feet as a podcaster, it's like, hey, I'm tackling the quote unquote golden years of Cage, that mid 90s stretch. And then like when I found my feet and then like when it's established, it's like, hey, come listen to the 2000s, like straight to VOD stuff where he needs loads of money. And then like, it's like, oh, great. Now nobody will want to, like, do you know what I mean? Come listen to films about films you've never heard of.
It's an odd one, isn't it? And like, we were absolutely influenced and inspired to do what we're doing because of you, because of your previous iteration of this podcast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, absolutely. It came about just as we were kind of having a joke about Paul Dano. I think we're discussing Where the Wild Things Are on our wild triple bill, I want to say, back in the day. Oh, that's the thought police. I've got the windows open. It's middle of summer. It's frigging hot. So we were like kind of joking about like how pretty much he gets beaten up or heartbroken or screwed up in every single film he's in. And yeah, Matt was the genius who decided that let's not go chronological. Let's mix this up a bit. So we've ended up in the two seasons so far with some really interesting early stuff, some really shocking early stuff as well, but then some real heavy hitters already. So that's been a nice kind of nice run of things so far.
Perfect. Well, let's talk about the Coppola family. And as I always start these off, I always like to ask, when did you first become aware of the Coppola family? And what I mean by that is like that they were this spider's web entity of a film family.
Okay. So probably around the time I bought all three of the Godfather films on VHS from my local Woolworths. and it was, I think it was like £5 a film, but it was like three for £10. So I got the Godfather trilogy on VHS for a tenner. And it was just even in that, you know, and getting fascinated, adoring those films, just going, oh god, that's his sister, and oh god, that's the father is the composer. And that it was just this becomes this cascade suddenly of like all of these, you know, filmmakers in their own right that happen to be in those films.
What are your thoughts on like the whole like nepotism angle that a lot of people level at the Coppolas? Like, do you see it as like this weird insidious thing, or are you kind of like it's just like a loving like, oh no,
I think that sort of thing,
right, by my family.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I struggle with that. It's like nepotism is one of those things where, like, I don't know, maybe it's a classism thing. But if I'm seeing some toff prick in the UK, some actor who's a handsome streak of, you know, whatever, but there's not much to him, and it's like, oh, it's the grandson of, I don't know, like Vanessa Redgrave or some bollocks. Like then I get a bit funny with it. And I think that's probably my working classness shining through chip on my shoulder. But with regards to like with film and that, I think it's really hard. Like if you've got like, you know, family businesses, like whether it's, you know, my mum's side of the family, they had a coach works. They basically had coaches. And so it meant that my grandfather and his sons and, you know, some of my cousins all worked for this coach firm. You wouldn't look at that and go, fucking nepotism.
Yeah.
It's a family business to kind of, you know, godfather it a little bit. But it's the same way, I think, with certain actors as well. It's like if that's all you've known and you've been growing up on film sets and that's what you're really comfortable with, then, you know, I don't know if they get those roles and they're super not talented.
Yeah, I think that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah. You know, and they still, you know, it's that whole white men fail upwards thing. Like if it's still, you know, that if we're still getting the likes of, what's the guy's name? John Landis' son.
Oh, Max.
You know, who, in fairness, wrote, you know, Chronicles great, I think, but then everything post Chronicle has been a massive pile of shit, and also he's a terrible human being as well. You know, in those instances you're just like, oh no, man, it's no good. But like, you know, sometimes you know, I kind of get it. And, you know, you got a feel for Sofia Coppola as well in The Godfather 3, mm-hmm. being one of the main reasons why that film gets such shtick. And it's just like, well, she kind of had to come in at a pinch at the last minute to save the, you know.
Yeah.
So can't really blame her.
And it's that thing, like, I think to your point of if people are shit, that it feels a lot more icky when, like, they kind of get these roles undeservedly. Whereas, like, Sofia Coppola, I think, has proved in her own right that she deserves to be, like, where she is.
Oh, do you know what
I mean? Like, because out of the gate, like, The Virgin Suicides
is incredible. Yeah.
And then, like, what, Oscar winner for Best Original Screenplay with Lost in Translation. So it's not a case of, like, yeah, it's not that case. I guess there probably is somewhere down the line, like, people who aren't so deserved. And you can probably, I don't know, you might be able to figure that out from who hasn't been covered on this podcast so far. They're probably just like, they got a job definitely because of who their name
is. Oh, the name.
Yeah. So what would have been the first David Shire film that was scored by David Shire that you would have seen?
That's a really interesting one, but probably most people that are my age, it will have been Return to Oz.
Yes.
Got to have been. Yeah. That film, that's that typical kind of 80s thing where it's like, oh, it's for kids. It's totally going to fuck you up. I loved it as a kid because, you know, I was into that sort of thing. But that, then Short Circuit was the year after. So, and then, like, yeah, Vice Versa, that terrible, it's just Freaky Friday, but with Judge Reinhold. That's all it is. They're probably the first ones I saw were the kids ones, you know.
What?
And then, like, obviously, like, one of my faves would have come much, much, much later, and that's Zodiac.
Yeah.
Because that's outstanding.
Which is really fascinating because I think David Fincher was just temp scoring with David Shire's music because it's kind of got, especially his 70s stuff that we'll talk about a lot more when it comes to Taking the Pill and 1-2-3, but it's got this bombast and use of, like, almost like discordant sounds. And
yeah,
like, I think it just got to a point and someone's like, why don't you ask David Shire to do the music instead of, like,
I love that.
Yeah, I think there was going to be just like actual doing a Tarantino and then just lifting stuff wholesale from David Shire films. And then he wrote that kind of, there's a thing to do with, like, the actual Zodiac signs, and every piece of music on that score, like, relates to it. And that's where we get, like, these, I think that again is quite, like, discordant and a bit out there and stuff like that. But, like, yeah, David Shire seems to really know what he's doing. And back to what you talk about, Return to Oz, like, that's directed by another, like, Francis Ford Coppola alumni as well, with Walter Murch, like, the kind of,
right,
the
yeah.
guy who's credited for inventing sound design because he was like a secondary editor on The Conversation and couldn't get, like, because there was already another editor and he'd done so much with the sound of that film, they just invented the term sound editor for that, or sound design.
Fantastic.
For that film. Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus.
So let's talk about Taking of the Pelham 1-2-3.
1:23 p.m. A crowded subway train starts its run from Pelham Station in the Bronx. 1:45 p.m. Four desperate, heavily armed men seize control of the train.
Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
Taking 17 people as hostages.
Your attention, please. Now then, you'll all remain seated. Anybody who tries to rise is going to get shot. I do hope I have made myself understood.
2:13 p.m. The city of New York is given 1 hour to come up with $1 million ransom.
You're out of your skull.
No, all units stand by on a double.
What's up, Z?
A train's been hijacked.
Millions have read it. Now you can live it. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
There is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages.
Nothing will happen as long as you obey my orders.
New York City is held powerless in the grip of four ruthless men. From the mayor's office.
Don't tell me, I don't want to know.
To police headquarters.
I've got about 50 men inside the tunnel, all wearing vests and armed with machine and submachine guns. We could fight the Third World War down there.
To the nerve center of the world's busiest subway system.
My only priority is saving the lives of these passengers.
Maybe an hour isn't enough time.
An hour is plenty of time.
We agree to pay the ransom. Repeat, we agreed to pay you the money. Now turn your clock off. The money has to be counted, stacked, tied, transported uptown. It just isn't physically possible.
You'd be surprised what's physically possible.
Pelham 123's in motion.
There's no driving a train.
How long does it take to get all that money together anyway?
Not gonna make it.
We'll never make it. The passengers are dead ducks.
What the hell do they expect for that lousy 35 cents to live forever?
Walter Matthau, Robert Shaw. The most spectacular hijack in history. The taking of Pelham 123.
When would you have first seen taking over the Pelham 123, and what was your first reaction?
There's a question. So I would have probably caught this on telly. Oh, would I have, though? Would I have sat through adverts to watch this? I don't know. It was either late night on like a Channel 4 type thing, mm-hmm. or back in the early days of DVD, I think I probably picked up what is essentially the vanilla release of this.
Yeah, the only one that's available now, right?
Yeah, I cannot believe the disrespect this film has had in terms of releases over the years.
So I'm not sure if yours is the same as mine, but like watching it on like a widescreen TV, it is in widescreen, but then it's still in like boxed in, so it was like,
oh shit, yeah,
so I might as well have just watched it on a laptop, because it's like it was like the screen is halved and then just like, yeah, like in widescreen, so I was like across the room going like, what the fuck, like this needs like a kind of premium Blu-ray release, because I imagine there's like there's plenty of nerds out there who'd write essays on it, and I'm sure there's plenty of like,
of course,
great stories from the set, because this is like beautifully, like, I don't know, it feels very of the time and of the place of New York. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's definitely, it feels like especially considering that the year after this, you know, there's lots of talk in this about, you know, that nobody likes the mayor and it's their second year and everything's fucked and they've got no money in the city. And that was literally what was happening in New York in 74 and 75. 75, the city of New York very nearly went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. There was like no money there at all. And there's this, like, you can go online and find some great articles about this. There's one in the New York, from the New Yorker. It's actually worth a read. So yeah, this was a city that was like, had no money. And you hear all this talks that all these stories that the film crew wanted to film with in the underground. And they were just like, well, sure, but you can't have any graffiti. You can't show it how it actually is, because it was so horrible at the time. It was so gross. And yeah, the fact that what we get here is very different to that. It still feels like the attitudes very much feel like a time capsule mm-hmm. of the era. In terms of there's lots of fuck bombs in this movie, and lots of people that are just like really aggravated and upset and miserable and intense and anxious. Which definitely speaks to the era for sure.
There's like a big vein of
Petros. You've frozen on me again, buddy.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now you're moving. Now, yes. I don't know what happened there. Wheeled it to existence.
Your picture froze, but I could still hear you perfectly. So it's just like, fingers crossed. There's a massive vein.
I'm sorry, This is gonna be a fucker for you to edit.
It's all right, man. I relish. I'm a few weeks ahead, so this will be a nice little challenge for me.
Jesus.
There's a like massive vein of cynicism that runs throughout this film, and I like I love it. Like, you kind of some of like the tertiary side characters in this, whether it's I think it's Carell, the like the train operator, the guy who first speaks to the hijackers, and like all his concern throughout the whole film is like, hey, when am I going to get, when am I going to get the trains back on, like on the tracks?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What the fuck are you doing? Like, I just want to do this. And we get the guy who like wants to go down and check on it. I think it's, what's his name? Like Dolites or something like that. And he's like, he again is like, just like, what the hell's going on? He's like watching the bleeps
just
on the
old floor. Timers. They're just used to everything working a certain way, and their whole lives are, you know, they, in another world, they'd have all been like watchmakers or something, you know? But yeah, I love that. And I love that kind of aggressive Aggie nature is just, it just permeates through this. It doesn't paint anybody in like a heroic light, really. I mean, even Garber himself is. He's Walter Matthau. It's seeing him with a gun at the end is a bit like this like dissonance in your head. I nearly had some sort of like psychotic fugue state for a minute. It goes like seeing Walter Matthau with a gun. It's like, what? What's this? It's like Tom Selleck without a mustache.
So
odd.
I've got a confession to make. This was a first time watch for me, and my second ever Walter Matthau film. The first being 1993's. Dennis the Menace. So this was a breath of fresh air for me in like,
holy shit,
what this man can do. And obviously a bit confusing because I'm like, oh, he's crotchety Mr. Wilson. He's not like, and then like in the, and then obviously having a look like he's got this great thing in the 70s where he's like, seems to be just like bouncing between like comedies, whether it's like The Odd Couple and then like more serious stuff. With this, and I think this film has this great element of comedy to it, and like utilizes people like Walter Matthau or even like Jerry Stiller, who have this like human, like humorous quality to them that makes this film feel real and like human, and that like I don't know, like it just feels like real people going through this event. So
it's not like Beautiful People, you know, like you know what, that's the funny thing is besides I think Denzel in the 2009 remake, you know, it's not, that film's not really full of beautiful people either. I think they get that kind of right there, but you could totally see another version of this where it's, you know, it's all of the better looking actors of the day. You're going to have a Robert Redford in here somewhere or something, you know. But yeah, I dig that. It adds to the verisimilitude of the thing. And Walter Matthau, I've recently caught Walter Matthau in a film called A New Leaf from 71, which is fantastic. It's an Elaine May film, and it's, and she also co-stars in it. And that's a thorough recommend from me. But yeah, I'm a bit like some of the bigger Walter Matthau films, like some of his Jack Lemmon stuff, besides the Grumpy and Grumpier Old Men films, which I have seen. I haven't seen any of the heavy hitters, which is, you know, it's pretty shit on my part, I've got to say. Got to get on them. But this is a year before Robert Shaw was in Jaws.
Yeah.
He's so menacing, isn't he?
There's a lot of cast members in this that are like people who... So yeah, let's kind of like have a little look through the cast and see who we've got here. So obviously we have... We've mentioned Walter Matthau as Garber, Robert Shaw as Blue, Martin Balsam as Mr. Green, Hector Elizondo, who, gonna throw this one out there, has got a Coppola connection, has been covered on the podcast as he is in The Princess Diaries as like the chauffeur to the... And then Earl Hindman, who most people may recognize the top of his head, as he is Mr. Wilson in Home Improvement, like the neighbor next door.
Mm.
And then, yeah, kind of, as we've mentioned before, we've got Jerry Stiller as Rico Patron, and then Lee Wallace as the mayor, Tom Petty, who is, Kaz Dolwights, who I mentioned earlier, the kind of crotchy old guy, Dick O'Neill. Let's be honest, it's an absolute sausage fest of a film.
Totally. This feels very much like a boy's own movie, you know. This is like a man's movie. And I think it's probably, you know, this would have been the book itself is one of those like airport novel like page turners. It's like your Dan Brown of your era type thing. But yeah, it's like no nonsense. You know, the guy who wrote it was a massive fucking train spotter. He's just a big, he was a big old nerd who was like, I could weave this into a novel. And so like, yeah, like the novel itself, came out, you know, did incredibly well just before this as well. And then, so the film rights were bought up for snapped up for an insane amount of money for the time. I read something like $800,000 or something. Wow. Ridiculous. But yeah, from the back of that, you know, there's very few things that kind of like they either omitted, like he goes into a lot more detail on how they were going to pull off the heist in the book. Mm-hmm. And the transport authority, like, you cannot mention all this shit in your film because we will have people doing this. So they had to just take several steps away from it in order to make it so it wasn't so believable.
Well, I think there's a mixed narrative. There's like kind of like different narratives in the book as well, where it kind of takes
the
different like men on the train, like the robbers on the train. Mm-hmm. And so like, because you kind of get glimpses that it's like, it doesn't go too much into how they know each other or anything like that. Because you could imagine, I'm not sure if the book does it, but like a kind of like, almost like whodunit, like, do you know what I mean? Of like, who are, like, who's against who? Like, we obviously get that in this film, like, because it seems to be in like the last third when you start to realize that they're kind of all against each other almost.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like every man for himself. And like, but yeah, we only really get what the backstory on Robert Shaw's character and Martin Balsam's like Mr. Green. Just, and again, that seems to be there because
the two biggest actors that are there as well.
The plot, right? Is that, Robert Shaw's just kind of, I don't know. Yeah, let's talk about Robert Shaw. What do you make of this performance?
I dig it. I love the fact that it's he's always one of these actors that can do like understated well, whether it's as Red Grant in From Russia with Love, mm-hmm. or if it's, you know, if it's Wint in Jaws. You know, he does understated incredibly well, and it's like a menace, he's simmering almost. Mm-hmm. You know, he's still kind of on the boil a little, but yeah, he's great in this. He really is. I like the fact that we kind of get to see that he's like a shark. You know, whereas somebody like, you know, your Hector Elizondo's Mr. Gray is a psychopath. He's a complete psycho, and that you get these very, very different. You know, like you can tell, like, they all met in the joint, right? They all met in prison. So there's that kind of sense of like, right, you set up this job with the people that you have around you at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead of like getting out and then going, right, now I'm going to put a crew together, which would have probably been the more sensible way of doing it. I love the use of the colors as well. Mr. Blue, Mr. Green, Mr. Gray, Mr. Brown.
Yep. I wonder who's made that extremely popular.
This is it. Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I was just thinking about this now. That's eye colors, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would have been possibly what, yeah, that's cool. I dig that. I love the fact that the mayor is a really weak-willed twat. I think that's really cool. I love the fact we've got Julius Harris in this as well. Like, that's two Bond villains we've got in this film. So obviously Robert Shaw was in From Russia with Love. Julius Harris was Teehee in was he Teehee? Yeah, he was Teehee in Live and Let Die.
Mm-hmm.
The guy with the claw hand thing.
I'm not a big
Bond dude. Man. Yeah, yeah. It's a Roger Moore one as well. So it's shit. So don't worry about it. But yeah, so that's just two Bond villains in this, which I kind of dig. But again, it's a man's man film of the era. You're going to have a lot of these, you know, men's men. You know, they don't have to be super attractive, chisel jawed dudes. They can just be guys that are off doing their jobs.
I wanted to talk about how this film, like, they set up the villains of the piece. I think it's really interesting in that it's no exposition and like that. You kind of like, I think Hector Elizondo's character, Mr. Gray, is introduced to the film perfectly with like this kind of lick of the lips at this woman. And you immediately go, he's a fucking piece of shit, isn't he? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's creepy, yeah.
And the way the film, like, gets you into it by, like, we get that shot of the conductor talking to, like, the guy who's, like, training him and stuff like that. And it doesn't spoon-feed you who anyone is or anything like that. It's kind of like you just kind of feel like a bit of a fly on the wall, like the kind of the way the camera, like, pans round to them and then carries on down the train and then into the carriage itself as Mr. Grey gets on. And then when, like, Robert Shaw's character turns up as the fourth man on the train, we get this, like, great scene as, like, the pressure starts to mount.
Hey, how am I supposed to see what you... Holy God, what do you want?
I'm taking your train.
You're taking my train?
Turn around, I got something to show you.
What's going on? What
Shut up.
I won't tell you again. Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
What do you make of this, like, the way the film is set up and, like, Joseph Sargent's kind of direction to kind of build the tension to the inevitable hijacking of the train?
I think it's amazing how it works so well, like, how the music works so well with it. Like, what we've got with what David Shire is doing here is, again, those lovely kind of bass tones, you know, and we've got brass in there that are just, and it's just these short stabs that, you know, it's not quite a heartbeat, but it has you get this sense of impending doom, like shit's about to go down, especially with off the top end of that, you've got like little snare stabs as well, which kind of speaks to kind of military and military precision, which is what I think most about, say, you know, Mr. Blue as well, because he's a mercenary. Kudos for them to decide that he was a British mercenary who was working in Africa, and they didn't give him a South African accent, because that would have been the lazy thing that you tend to get a lot more of these days. But I love that. You know, we do. You start off with this... again, just the you're right, but the fly on the wall thing of like the training for this guy who announces the wrong friggin' station just before, and then at the next station, the guy goes, "Well, you're doing all right. See you later." And you're like, "No, he just fucked up. Like, dude, what are you leaving him there?" Like,
it gives a perfect like summation of what 70s New York was like. He says to him at one point, he says like he apologizes over the tunnel, and he's like, "Hey man, don't apologize. Like, you never know who's gonna somebody will hit you for that shit." And it's like you get that sense of like, this is an unforgiving place to live. Like, this is everybody's like out for themselves, out for each other. And like, it's no nonsense. And that's what I kind of like love about 70s cinema and especially this film.
Yes, 70s cinema is definitely, it's probably my favorite decade for that reason. But I do have this. I have this real weakness for this, like a 20-year period of films from the 70s and 80s, 70s and into 80s New York. Mm-hmm. So your films of your William Lustigs and, you know, or your Frank Hennenlotters. So things like your Maniac Cop or your Basket Case or Maniac or like, you know, Ms. 45, which I caught recently, the Abel Ferrara film. Like, it's a very specific type of New York that only existed for a 20-year period. Until Ghostbusters cleaned it up in Ghostbusters 2, right? it's amazing, and I can't get enough of it whenever we see it, you know. Here it's just perfect. It reminds me of like at any moment the Warriors could be getting this underground, like totally. It's way out of their it's way out of their zone, but still, like you could totally imagine them in this as well. Like it's got Walter Hill vibes all over it.
Yeah, definitely. So talking of Walters, let's talk about Walter Matthau and his introduction to the film as Garber. Here's a clip of when he first speaks to, I think it's Mr. Blue. Yeah.
Pelham 123, come in, please.
This is Pelham. Identify yourself, please.
Oh, this is Lieutenant Zachary Garber of the Transit Police. Identify yourself, please.
I'm the man who stole your train.
Well, sir, there is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
Why do you concern yourself with that?
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages. Don't you think you better get in touch with the mayor and get back to me for my further instructions? Over and out.
That son of a bitch has got me backed up all the way to the front. All right, what is this, a circus? Come on, for Christ's sake, let's get back to work.
Rico, did you get that?
I only get your end of it, but I can piece the rest of it together.
How is Walter Matthau introduced into this film? Because I think that's kind of interesting what's going on at the MTA at that moment.
I love the fact that, yeah, he's... And this actually speaks to the remake as well, but like he's supposed to be like glad handing and showing around a group of members of the Tokyo's underground network, yeah. And yeah, he's showing them around, but obviously because of the limited understanding or their perceived limited understanding of the English language, he's basically walking around saying any old shit and being quite rude about them mm-hmm. to anybody that's around, because obviously everybody at work there seems to be listless and not really giving two shits. And it becomes very apparent, like when shit starts to go awry, and that they can all totally understand and speak English. And it's funny. It's like to have such a, like, you know, we've built up all this pressure already in that opening reel. So then suddenly you just let it go just a little bit. You ease off from the pressure in this humorous moment, because, you know, those are few and far between as it breaks into the start of the second act.
I love that kind of reveal, because when the Japanese businessman, like, no perfect English, especially because it's just come after like what could be perceived as like an out and out racist line, where you've got like the train operator kind of going like, "Oh, why the hell we got these Chinamen in here?" And it's like,
yeah,
like, which obviously like is definitely a sign of the times with a film like this. And do your thing of levity as well. I think, like, I personally love there's a moment with Rico, and he calls like the one of the guys, yeah, one of the traffic cops who would have been on the platform, and like he's saying to him like, "Keep it quiet, like I'm gonna tell you something." And we get that great bit of levity where he's like, "The train's been hijacked," and then straight away his reaction is, "Holy shit!" Like,
yeah, oh man. Look, we've also got, we're not really brought up yet, but Martin Balsam in this. And Martin Balsam, you know, from all manner of things, you know, like, I think the first time I would have ever seen him would have been Psycho, but obviously he's in 12 Angry Men, and like he's one of those guys that you look back at a lot of like films that regard widely regarded as classics, and you just go, holy fuck, Martin Balsam's in that as well. Like, he's just one of those guys. And he's here, you know, just, you know, with his cold, which apparently was, you know, it was not part of the, it's not in the novel that character has a cold. It's something that was, you know, for the film itself, which sets up something that, like, one of my favorite closings of any film ever, where this cold, you know, comes back. But he's great. He adds so much texture, I think, to what could have otherwise just been another hijacker. I will say this. I think Earl Hindman as Mr. Brown, he's probably the least, you know, I don't know if it's the performance or just how he was written. We don't get much of Mr. Brown.
What is quite interesting about this, obviously, they're all in dislike. Well, all of them bar Shaw's character seem to be in like some level of like prosthetics almost, or like, do you know what I mean? They have like these, we get that like reveal near the end where they've kind of got this like plan to bag up all of their clothes, turn their jackets inside out. And you see them kind of like peeling mustaches off and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, they're like, cause they all kind of look relatively the same at that point as well, when they first get on the train. And like, I remember like at one point, I think with the Earl Hindman character, I was like, I swear there was four guys who got on the train. Because there's like a good like 45-minute chunk of the film where he like doesn't even seem, you don't see him at all. And I'm like, a bit like, that seems a bit bizarre. Do you know what I mean? Like, and it's, his character doesn't doesn't seem to have an archetype, right?
I think it's really interesting. He doesn't get much characterization, and neither does really anybody on that carriage.
Yes.
Something that, you know, kind of say that the Tony Scott remake does go to some lengths to attempt to give us several characters in that carriage that we can root for as an audience. But this really doesn't. We're treated to everybody that works with the transport authority, everybody that works with the police, we get little bits of texture and dimensionality to them. But besides, like, the fact that the, you know, Hector Elizondo's character has been super sleazy to the woman with the cleavage, we don't really get much of any of them, really. You got those two bratty kids, but honestly, I don't know how he didn't put a bullet in them when they started to fuck around. Like, Jesus. Like, seriously, is that a real gun? Kid, do you want to test that? Fucking idiot. Yeah, good grief. Yeah.
Well, like, one of the things that, like, we get on that train carriage, like, with some of the people, because we get that, like, well, it's like a really long joke. Well, like, do you know what I mean, for the payoff to come, we get that, like, drunkard who's, like, falling asleep. We get, like, a bottle of booze, like, Leonard. And then we have that, like, I guess this is where, like, a whodunit comes into it. It's like, who is the policeman? Because we get that, like, kind of reveal early on that somebody or, but yeah, like, and Walter Matthau, very, it feels quite progressive for the time. It's like, do we, well, apart from his wording, it's like, do we know if it's a dame or not? It could be a dame. Yeah, yeah. Like, but yeah, like that, I think that kind of pressure cooker thing of like, oh, there is somebody inside who could be there to help them. But then, like, you spend like a lot of the film waiting for that to come to a fore, right?
Well, I think you wait for them to do something stupid, which is like, I think that was more of a trope of the 80s and 90s, where whether it's a bank heist or whatever, you'd always get that guy, the good guy with a gun, who ends up getting blown away. And we don't get that here. Like, while they're on the carriage, while the main part of the hijackings happened, the hostage situation, you don't get any of that. And I thought that shows a lot of restraint.
Yeah.
You know, it's only when the train starts to pull away, and then when they jump from the train, they clearly, you know, whoops, they go. Nobody touches that middle rail until we get that horrific conclusion for
I've got that right here.
I suppose you couldn't use $250,000, could you?
$250,000? Oh, no, thanks. My accountant says that I've accepted enough for this fiscal quarter. You're the English guy on the radio.
Yes. Lieutenant Garber.
Right. Do you want to move along?
Excuse me, do you people still execute in this state?
What? Oh, execute. No, not at the moment.
Pity.
Hey!
Oof.
What I find like fascinating about that kind of, I don't know, it's not, well, I think it is very archetypal of the 70s, is like that kind of anti-ending. Do you know what I mean? Of like the big bad. It's not like this thing of like what we would get nowadays where it's like a big showdown. It's literally like he catches him and goes, well, fuck this. I'm going out. Like, I'm touching the, but apart from like the, as the camera's panning up, I did almost expect to see like a Indiana Jones style like face melt or something.
I was expecting a lot more smoking, just like, just searing
steaming
skin.
Out the ears.
Like, he's the only one. And we get like moments early on where like loads of people like evacuating, you know, running through the underground. I'm just like, I would be shit scared to accidentally go anywhere near that. That's I'd be as scared as that as I am of getting shot. That's for sure. But yeah, we don't get any of that. Again, that guy, the good guy with the gun, the police officer, is the hippie.
Yeah.
That down, dirty, stinking hippie we see, who seems a bit, you know, like 5 years too late for it to have really been a thing. But you know. Hipster, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's the dude. He's got his little ankle piece. But yeah, he's he manages to get some shots off that count in the end. But then also, he doesn't bite it, does he? Water Matthau saves him from getting iced by. Yeah,
that's what I mean. Again, we don't like if this was made in the 90s. Well, it was, but that's we'll talk about that a bit later. It like you would have seen like him getting carted away in like an ambulance, something like that. Whereas in the 70s, you just get a thing of like, hey, buddy, we're gonna get an ambulance for you. That's all we need. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He said it's going to happen. It'll probably happen. Do you know what I mean? Like, so
it's New York. It might take about 3 hours.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly. They might. Yeah, yeah. Is there any other particular scenes that like really stand out to you in this? That kind of like,
I mean, like going back to the humor as well. Like the fact that when Garber goes up top and meets Deputy Inspector Daniels for the first time, and clearly there's racial overtones to that, as you know, he goes, oh, I thought you'd be taller, I think is the line. Clearly not realizing that obviously this guy who's high up in the New York police force is a black guy, and I think it throws him briefly, and you can just see how Daniels just shrugs it off like he has to deal with this shit every day.
That's what I really like about this film, and it's the way that they do it with the Japanese characters earlier, is it almost like leads you into, oh, is this very like 70s in attitude? But then like, it's almost like the filmmakers know, and then like, do you know what I mean? Like the character, Daniels is in, do you know what I mean? Like it gives us a little bit, like you said, like Daniels knows like, that he gets this every day. So it's not like a thing of just like, oh, Walter Matthau's character is racist. It's like, oh, like, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not the
it's
filmmaker.
It's the assumption.
Going, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the filmmaker going, hey, like, You know what I mean?
No, I know what you mean. Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Julius Harris is one of those actors as well who, like, at that period of time was in some incredible stuff. And I'm not just talking about Bond, but, like, you know, he did, he was in Shaft's Big Score. He was in, Islands in the Stream. I only just watched that recently, which is another 70s film. He was in Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem. You know, he was in he was in the 1976 King Kong film as well. He did some amazing things in the 70s, man. But yeah, he's Superfly in 72 as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then like towards the end of his career, things like Maniac Cop 3, Badge of Silence.
One of the big things I noticed whilst like researching this film is, I think it's something like 18 members of the cast have been in an episode or like a movie of like a Kojak. There's a lot of like Kojak alumni in this, or it seems to be a lot of them like the years after this as well, because and then a lot of them were in the Terry Savalas TV series he did before called like the Jack something murders or something like that.
Okay. That
almost feels like a precursor to Kojak, because it's like, instead of he's got a trilby on instead of a lollipop in his mouth, so he's still got an affectation, but it's a bit different. And I kind of like that. And I think it shows that the film is kind of this, I don't know, like creme de la creme of like New York actors of the time. Like,
yeah.
Especially like, I don't know. Yeah. Like Jerry Stiller. Let's talk like, well, what do you think of Rico in this film?
I love the fact that he's in this and he's not playing like, you know, there's no comic relief in this. There's no real, you know, but for what he is, he feels just like a guy. Yeah. It's like a guy working there in that role. It's one of those things where like, how many times do you watch a film and it's got like, again, some handsome piece of slab of white bread playing like an architect or something. And it's just like, you're not a fucking, you've never once dealt with like, yeah. Or like when somebody's like, the classic is, Natalie Portman in the Thor films as a astrophysicist. And you're just are you though?
Yeah.
Whereas any one of the actors in this film, I'd be like, yeah, you totally work for the Metro. Like, you absolutely, of course you do. Or if you don't now as an actor, you certainly did in the past.
Yeah. I love the fact that when he gets to take control to speak to the hijackers, you just get that New York cynicism straight away. Like, cause they're like, who are you? And he says who he is. And they're like, where's Garber? And he's like, well, everybody's got to go take a piss. It's just like straight with the sass. There's no like, do you know what I mean? It's like everyone there you just get this feeling that they all just want to fucking go home and get on with their job.
Yeah. They all want to go home, be really horrible to their wives and hate their children and then come into work the next day, which they will also hate, but for different reasons. Yeah. Absolutely. Until they have a heart attack at the age of like 57, because that's what everybody did. You know, it's a knock on effect from when they were in their, you know, younger guys in their 20s drinking, on the job or whatever. And like that kind of, again, mid 70s, it's like we're not that far removed from everybody smoking all the time and everybody drinking whiskey for breakfast. That's it.
That's,
you know,
the one thing I was like, very perplexed about this film is that, like, I expected that Metro office to just be awash with cigarette smoke. Yeah. And it's only like we have to like wait until what, like the final scene to see someone.
Mm.
And again, that's the only thing that makes me, is this like a plot contrivance or something? Do you know what I mean?
Maybe. I always think with things like, especially if you've got people in the background smoking or not smoking, well, smoking, it's What's the continuity error right? So if everybody's like smoking, it's like, oh, in that scene they've got like half a cigarette left, and this one they've got the stub left, and you know, like maybe it's issues like that, or maybe if they were shooting, if some of this was on location, that might have had something to do with it, or maybe the Rail Authority, you know, already at the time of the 70s, I don't know, might have had a no smoking policy in their offices.
I know that Robert Shaw managed to convince Hector Elizondo to give up smoking whilst making this film.
Fantastic.
And like he sounded like he would have been a little bit of like tough work. Like I'm not sure if it's the characters that Robert Shaw plays, but like he had a proviso that they had a ping pong table for when he wasn't shooting. And apparently he's shit hot. He's like Forrest Gump levels of good at ping pong, and was just like kind of absolutely owning anyone who came to challenge him, which sounds like, that's what I mean. Where's the Blu-ray release? Where's the footage of Robert Shaw playing ping pong, like short shorts, and then like getting ready to get back on that train?
Yeah, it's upsetting, man, because I mean, I know like Robert Shaw was already long gone, and Martin Balsam as well, but there's a few, like Hector Elizondo, I'd love to see, you know, some interviews with him, and you know, just there's still people that, even if you'd have had like a good DVD release in 2004 to mark your 30th anniversary, like you could have had some of these actors still here to talk this film up. Instead, I think the best they've got is like three very short interviews on the American disc, and then there's a commentary. So even then, like, you know, in America where you'd expect, and we kind of get fucked over in the UK, don't we? Where we look at, say, the American releases, and it's just like, you sons of bitches. Yeah. But no, it turns out that, no, everybody seems to disrespect the taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, it's bizarre, because I've got a DVD copy of the Tony Scott one that is just packed full of...
That's features. It, man.
Yeah, but my DVD copy of Taking Over the Pelham 1, 2, 3, has all it's got is the theatrical trailer.
That's your woo!
Yeah, and scene selection.
Jesus.
So let's kind of talk about how the heist itself, like, takes place and the kind of workings of it. Obviously, they try and tackle it somewhat in the 2009 one, but do you think a film like this, what do you think, Taking Over the Pelham 1, 2, 3, it's going to become
it's more nuts and bolts here, right?
Yeah.
So it's a lot more nuts and bolts. It's exactly what they're after. Whereas, like, I will say this, I watched the remake for this as well, just because I'd never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of late era Tony Scott that I just kind of have dismissed, because, you know, that's what people do with films like Unstoppable. But yeah, like I dig the fact that they took it into a more timely place. You know, the stock market as of 2009, obviously, you know, stock markets, blah 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 blah. I dug that side of things with it. This felt very much like this is all it is. I had not seen this film in nearly 20 years, and so for me, I was expecting a rug pull and there to be something else to it. But it transpires that. If they're all taking away $250,000 in 1974 money, that equates to $1.25 million in today's money each, which still doesn't seem like much. But when the city is that like fucked financially, then that's it's the best you could do, right?
Well, yeah, back then, you would have owned a house.
Do you
know what I mean? And had money to spare.
This is it. Money worked differently in the before times, sure. Yeah. But yeah, I love the fact that it's a little bit more stripped down here. I dig that it's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. It must have seemed in the joint like a really straightforward plan to put together, especially when you've got like an inside man, technically.
Yeah, because like obviously when we get that reveal that their plan is Daniels assumed it could be that the train would just keep on going. And then we get like the reveal from Garber that, the trains have a dead man switch. You see, you gotta always have a hand on it. And then I love the kind of when he realizes that that's not the way, that he just goes, they must have figured out a way around it. And it's like, cause you see them tinkering with the train, but you don't need an explanation. You just see someone with tools and go, they must know what they're doing, right?
Yeah. I like that they don't come onto the radio for a good long while. And that's kind of the last. And that's the radio silence is what starts to make the Garber go, there's something else going on here. Mm-hmm. And they keep trying to contact them and getting no response. It's like, okay, right. So what's down? You know what? Looking at both of these now, that remake got a lot of things right. Yeah. Like in the 1974 version, one of the snipers, the police snipers, fires off a round and catches Mr. Brown in the arm. But there's no explanation as to it. Whereas they do give an explanation in the 2009 version, which I thought was totally, I get it. It's a rat crawls up a sniper's leg and bites him. And he accidentally shoots.
Well, in the 2009 one as well, they kind of, it feels like you've almost got Mr. Grey and Mr. Blue rolled into one, because like Travolta comes in with like the energy of just like, he is a fucking madman. I don't think like you would get Robert Shaw delivering this line, for instance.
You can lick my bunghole, motherfucker.
I wish I'd have paid folding money to see that movie. I in hindsight, looking back, because I watched these in like reverse order. It was the 2009 version first, because I thought, well, that's the one. If it's shit, at least I can then watch the good one afterwards. Exactly. And I came away from it going, actually, this is pretty good. This is really solid.
Well, because time constraints, I managed to like watch like half of the 2009 one, and now I'm like kind of, it's that thing like came to record. I'm itching to like see how it ends.
Yeah, it's good. I think Denzel's pretty boring in it, because I love Denzel Washington in most things, but this definitely felt like, I just get to sit in a chair and talk into a microphone for a lot of the film. Okay, cool. And he brings that energy to it, which is a real shame, because I love him when he gives a shit. But you can 100% tell that John Travolta he's a hungry man in that. He's chewing so much scenery, and I dig it. I dig that role.
It's a real shame with Denzel, because especially with Tony Scott, like they seem to be like a really undersung partnership of like actor and director, because they kind of like, whether you like them or not, like they seem to have like, they got, there's a big streak of films they did together, right? Whether it's like Taking the Pelham 1-2-3, Unstoppable,
Deja Vu
is Man on Fire. That's a Tony
Man
Scott.
Man on Fire. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It seems to be like they, yeah, they don't get their like. They do this great little, they had this great little run together, and everyone feels like a different Denzel. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
So
it made no money though, dude. made no money. It's a terrible shame.
Which compared to this one, that kind of like definitely washed its face, because on $3.8 million budget, did $18.7 million. So, and
I think the 18.7 is just domestic as well. So it doesn't tell you what that made internationally, which I mean would have done amazingly well, I think, internationally. And then this is like pre your rent. Like, this would have been like, if not syndicated, but this would have been on television a lot as well. This film would have done very well for itself back in the day.
Apparently, cities it did really well in was New York, Paris and Tokyo, because they all have subways. They were like coming three of their like beacon places where like people were like, I gotta go see this. And like, I love that like this film now has actually made it that no train ever leaves Pelham Station at 1:23, either if it's AM or PM. That like it kind of it's created this legacy that like
it's like with theaters and the Scottish play, isn't it? It's like you can't do it. I really dig it. I caught this, and then last night I went onto the underground to head to Camden for dinner with my wife, and it was just like the minute I got on, I had this dun dun dun, dun 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 in my head. It was like, oh man, it's done that thing. The minute that went into the tunnel at East Finchley, I was just like, yeah, man, I'm digging this. I'm feeling it.
Yeah, it's like let's talk about this like drop, because it sets up the film, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in regards to David Shire's score, Daryl, he tends to like, there's only like 11 minutes like on the actual soundtrack, like on like the listed soundtrack for this film. Like, I'm not sure if you managed to find if it's streaming anywhere. Like, I looked
It's absolutely streaming on Apple Music.
Oh, fuck's sake. Yeah, so, it's not on Spotify at all. I kind of had to like find all they've got is the main theme, and then I had to like listen to it on YouTube a few times. But like,
oh, dude, a full 33-minute soundtrack is on there. Yep.
Oh man,
it's brilliant, and it has been soundtracking my last like 2 weeks of just doing anything. It's been like, okay, I need to go to the shops. Dun dun dun. Yeah. Like just whatever I've been doing, it's great. That discordant oddness, there's a word for it, and there's a term for it within music. I'm not very good with the actual terminology within music, but it plays around with this really chaotic, like non-traditional kind of discordant sounds.
Yes.
To the point where like, if you ask somebody to like listen to it and then hum it back to them, it's actually really difficult because those notes are going fucking everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's great. It reminds me a lot of like Lalo Schifrin's stuff for like the Mission Impossible series and stuff like that. When you listen to it, it's like just guys doing a job.
Yeah.
It's like missioning music. And it definitely has that vibe to it. But it is. It's playful but chaotic. but it's also like menacing as well.
There's a beautiful like moment in the film that really captures that. I think it's just after we have like the shootout and before the conductor's shot. There's like the tension's building, and we get these like almost like broken piano chords where it's like cling, cling. And then like low horns, just like very subtly, and then just like really high, like piano, like flutters and stuff like that. And I think like that stuff, like, because I don't know what it is about David Shire, especially around like this time as well. Because I think the score to The Conversation is like, again, fantastic in this kind of using this uneasy, discordant thing that kind of captures like that 70s paranoia perfectly.
It's brilliant shorthand for anxiety.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful. Yeah, it really does. Like, you don't need to have much going off on screen, but when you've got that going in the background, just it sets off those synapses and you're just like, oh, I feel really uneasy and I'm not quite sure why. In a completely different way, actually, the Clint Mansell score for In the Earth does a very similar thing. With more like soundscapey things going off, and like you'd just be sitting there just, and it'd just be like a feeling than anything you're seeing. You're just like, oh, like my fight or flight response has kicked in, and there's definitely an element of that here, right from the when we get the taking, which is track two on the soundtrack, which is very much that. It's just. Okay, right. That's when you got those little kind of again, I was talking about those snare kind of like patters, and the stuff going on with the brass as well. And it's like, oh shit, something's going awry here. I'm really, you know, kind of freaked out. But like, I think the beautiful thing is the conclusion of this film. We get like that main title, but just like extended.
Yeah.
And in all of its glory, and it works as a wonderful punchline to the conclusion we get to this film as well, which is like humorous, but in like a fist, you know, punch in the air kind of way. And then it's straight back into the absolutely no fucking nonsense, never mind the bollocks main title again. You're just like, whoa, and we're back.
So let's play a clip of that final moment we get with when Garber and Rico go to visit Mr. Green.
Come on, Mr. Longman, we'll be back later.
Yeah? Listen, I know I got a gripe with it here. I know I got a bum rap, but I wouldn't do anything as stupid as what you just told me. What do you think, I'm a jerk? Just do me a big favor, will you? Get the hell out of here, for Christ's sake.
Come on, Mr. Longman. We have to follow our leads. It's our job.
Yeah, big deal. Look, I got my rights. This is my home. I want a little peace. Well, just do me a little favor, will you? Get the hell out of here.
Sorry if we bothered you, Mr. Longman.
Sorry, Rico.
Gesundheit.
Hey!
What's perfect about this version of the score, like the main theme, it feels like a reprise and a bit like a slower tempo. It's still got that swagger, but feels like certain elements are very much like deconstructed. Like we kind of get those almost like, if it sounds like high tom, like dung dung, or like bongos, like and stuff like that, like added elements. And I know that.
It's the jazz side of things, right? Yeah. It's being able to break something down to its core elements and then bring them back in and then create something new from it as well. Yeah.
One question I wanted to ask you is, how much would you have loved to have seen a Walter Matthau, Jerry Stiller kind of like crime of the week TV series in the 70s? I think that kind of like last chunk when they're kind of shaking down all the potential guys that could have been the Motorman. I'm like, I would give big money to see that as a show.
Bottle this up. I want it. I want it now. Yeah, totally. Yeah, they work really well together as a duo. I can imagine them in like, you know, the Beastie Boys video for Sabotage.
Yeah.
Which is just fucking Jerry Stiller rolling over the bonnet of a patrol vehicle. Yeah. I've been all over that, man. Yeah, for sure.
I love the kind of like little weird interactions we get in that end bit where we get that guy who works like now on a toll booth.
Yeah.
And he's like kind of like
still makes him pay.
Yeah, he's like, you still gotta pay, and he's like, I don't work for you anymore, like probably like giving him shit. And I think that's the thing. Like, I'm so glad we've been able to be positive about a film that kind of just oozes cynicism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it seems to me it's kind of a hot beating heart of this film is the cynical nature of New York.
Yeah, I think that might be something to do with how that is ingrained in us as people in the UK. I think we have a lot of that anyway.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's probably what speaks to you and I with regards to our love of 70s New York is like shit like that. Some of that mindset exists now, but the thing is with a lot of English people, we have this veneer, this bullshit veneer. And like, you know, we think that, we feel that sometimes, but we don't really let loose in the same way that these guys are. There's so many like fuck bombs throughout this movie. And the amount of people saying fuck in this film. And I was like, holy shit, I was not expecting that. Totally forgot that.
I just find it all, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's, I don't know if this is an underseen film. Like, it's obviously like in certain camps, it's very like high regarded, but like,
yeah.
It is that thing like when you start to Google Taking of the Pelham, mm-hmm. Google now instantly goes,
it's the remake. Oh,
you want the Tony Scott one, do you? He goes,
yeah, yeah.
Well, no, actually, I want to watch the 1974 version, please.
Yeah, that is funny, isn't it? Yeah, and there's nary a mention of the 1998 television movie version which is such a shame.
Impossible to find in this country.
Mm-hmm. Like, it got a DVD release in the US and nowhere else. Yeah, yeah, as is always the way.
I've heard very mixed things about that, kind of like...
Yeah.
I listened to the Projection Booth podcast, and they kind of
said, all right,
it's wholly just kind of, you can skip that. But then again, they were very down on the 2009 remake. So,
okay.
That's not to put their their opinion into question. Let's move off this topic before I get myself in smart water and ask you, Daryl. Oh,
yeah, go for it. Sorry.
I was just going to ask you if you managed to find any Coppola connections, people who aren't like, or people who've in this film who have worked with a Coppola on something else somewhere down the line.
You know what? I did not know. I was solely trying to get entrenched in David Shire. So I've spent a good 2 or 3 weeks of just like, you know, bashing out some choice David Shire soundtracks.
No worries.
Yeah.
I will. Is there anything you feel like we've missed before I kind of rattle off a few little connections I managed to dig out?
I don't know, man. I think we've kind of we've hit an awful lot here within such a short space of time. But you're right. This is one that's highly regarded within the circles that I've seen it. And you know, if I'm not one to prescribe to the whole Rotten Tomatoes thing, but this is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes,
wow,
which means that every review has been a positive review for this film, which is pretty fucking incredible. You can see why. I mean, like, it's hard to find anything in this. Like, obviously there's, you know, maybe some elements that could be kind of excised for time or whatever, but this film has a character to it,
mm-hmm.
and tonally and this vibe, it all works so well. And this perfect storm that was 1974, for, you know, cinema across the board, and then just the state of where New York was,
mm-hmm.
you know, politically and socially in that era, it's perfect, yeah. in that regard. It really is. It's this wonderful kind of time capsule for that. And it's, you know, I think this is what we lose a lot of this shit going forward now, where we do very nostalgia based stuff of like, oh, we'll set something in the '80s, but nobody's smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll set something in the 1970s, but not a single person has said anything problematic. And you're like, and you're just like, well, you know, you can do that, because actually the Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3 has elements that it almost holds a mirror up to say, mm-hmm. oh, this is a thing that exists, but this is why we should be looking at that.
Yeah.
You know, in a different perspective. You know, the talk, you know, the minute that Garber mentions that the police person, that's a fucking stupid term, Daryl, might be a woman. That it was this weird little like grain of sand that then kind of starts to work its way around in there until it becomes this neat little pearl of every curmudgeonly old fucker on that thing just talking about, oh yeah, women cops and blah blah blah, mm-hmm. and the misogyny just starts to kind of come out in those other characters who we're already looking at going, boy, he's a piece of shit, he's a piece of shit, you know, like across the board. It doesn't matter if they work for the you know, Metro, or if they're one of the, you know, the four hijackers. It's like, oh, they're all pieces of shit, but it's a spectrum of pieces of shit.
Well, that is the '70s, right? And it's like, that is '70s cinema, and it's like, to bring it back to Zodiac, I think what that manages to perfectly do in regards to like this, like with that kind of David Shire connection, is it doesn't just feel like, it doesn't just capture the tone of 70s and like the look like immaculately. Feels like a 70s film because like the 70s is really good at like giving unsatisfying endings, like taking the Pelham 1-2-3 kind of bucks the rule somewhat because that ending is very much like a chef's kiss, like perfect, like gotcha. But even then it doesn't feel wholly resolved, do you know what I mean? Like we're like, Zodiac, the big criticism of that film is, well, you don't really know what happens at the end. It's like, well, based on a true thing, but like
it very, that's life.
Yeah, and it feels very much in keeping with like a lot of like 70s cinema where it is like at the end, like The Conversation being a prime example where like the kind of end of that is just a bit like, oh, it's pretty fucking bleak, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that and The Godfather 2. I mean, yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
1974. Nice time for, that's it, man. Nice time for some bleak cinema. Yeah, I'll rattle off a few of these Coppola connections. So Martin Balsam was also in All the President's Men, which was scored by David Shire. As I mentioned earlier, Hector Elizondo is in The Princess Bride with Robert Schwartzman. Beatrix Wind is in It Could Happen to You with Nicolas Cage. Rudy Bond, who plays the police commissioner, is in Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather as Cuneo. Robert Weil is in Saturday Night Fever and Moonstruck. I love these ones. Conrad Yama, who is one of the Japanese businessmen, plays a fruit vendor in The Godfather. So, like,
Jesus,
a very, very small credit.
Yeah.
And then, again, I'll just rattle out this one because it's... I like it when somebody is listed for a film, but not in the job that they did in this film, if you know what I mean. So Carmine Foresta is a policeman in Godfather 2, but he's also the New York location manager for 8mm, the Joel Schumacher film starring Nicolas Cage. So, yeah.
Holy shit.
There's a fair few more, but kind of gets a bit boring. I'm sure you could attest to this when you start to do your connections.
Links within the... the thing I love about David Shire is, like, whenever we think of Saturday Night Fever, we think of the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love that, especially in what we now consider either like a jukebox soundtrack, you know, film where like all we're thinking is the soundtrack. Some poor fucker has still scored that, that film. That's the real issue with Saturday Night Fever. It's a great David Shire score there, but that's not what you're thinking about when you think about Saturday Night Fever. You're thinking about the Bee Gees, you're thinking about, you know, everything else on there except for the really solid score.
Yeah, but I always think like it definitely, that must have been an amazing paycheck for him.
Oh God,
Still like Manhattan Skyline is still on that like all-time best-selling soundtrack. So he's still getting his bread. He's all right. Like, let's not be feel too sorry for David Shire. So as the Coppolas now seem to be, Francis more than anything, more concerned with wine. What would be your perfect wine pairing for this film, Daryl?
Oh my God! Oh, you see, I'm a man who doesn't drink much wine these days. You know what? I don't know how to answer that. I really don't. If you ask me about like real fucking like a beardy London thing, like if you ask me about stouts, now I could tell you that like a nice smoky, full-bodied stout would be perfect for this.
Yeah.
But in terms of wines, man, I'm sorry.
It's fine. Let's go with your stout pick for taking the Pelham 1-2-3 then.
Yeah, I'd definitely go for a smokier, like incredibly dark stout, something a little heavy, little full bodied, something that probably a bit pokey, you know, the higher percentage for a stout. So like you're like 13%er, something that you're gonna like sip, not amazing. Something you're gonna knock back.
So how much are we paying for this? Is this bottom shelf, mid shelf, probably or top shelf?
I don't know. For a stout, this is probably mid shelf. So probably you're looking at about £7 for a can.
Okay,
I know, right? Yeah.
That's what this film deserves. It's kind of
Totally. This is Friday night. Treat yourself, right? Get yourself a nice posh beer to start off with, right? And then you've got the rest for later. And then this isn't quite a beer and a pizza movie, is it? It's not like fun for your mates to all come round and watch. And it's not like a sitting on a Sunday in your rocking chair movie with a hangover either. It's definitely, I think this is like a treat yourself on a Friday night. If it's just you, sit at home, crack open a nice whatever.
If you're getting a pizza, you're going to either have to like proper like New York style it and do a Tony Manero. two slice one on top of the other. Or it's going to have to be like a wood fire. Do you know what I mean? It's going to have to be a wanky pizza. It's not going to be like a Domino's. Domino's. No. This isn't that affair. So I like to close these out by asking some ridiculous questions that I'm so glad I'm asking as opposed to answering. The first one of which is, which of the Coppola family members would you keep? You get to keep one, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies of the entire family.
Holy fuck. I'm going to have to keep Francis. Yeah. As boring as basic bitch as that answer is, it would be fucking foolish of me.
Is this on selfish grounds? Because I'm very interested.
Oh, dude, 100%.
Yeah, perfect.
100% without a shadow of a doubt, yeah. Fuck everyone else, you know. Seriously, I know like Jeanette Wood, my wife and podcast co-host. we have a fisherman podcast. But no, she struggles with The Godfather. But I don't, Petros, and that's what I think
is very telling is when Jeanette was on this podcast, her answer to that question was also Francis Ford Coppola, but on the basis of what he did for cinema. So hers was very selfless in like he's like the ripples he has made, and then you've kind of bolstered on and gone, fuck everyone else, it's Francis Ford Coppola. I love The Godfather and I love it, Daryl.
But like as well, like without him and American Zoetrope and everything that was going on there, you wouldn't, I mean, George Lucas would never have the back slaps he needed to then do what he did, and so on and so forth. And that whole kind of run of everybody we got in the 70s into the 80s. You take Francis out of that.
Amazing things. Even if it's like kind of giving like Kurosawa like another go at it.
Totally. Run's great. Kagamusha is great. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he saw these things and like wanted like there's Zoetrope's story, I think, is a podcast all to itself, where it's like a book or some kind of doctor that especially the studio itself, like the kind of like a big, yeah, like ridiculous whole affair that he did with One from the Heart and stuff like that. It's just the guy managed to, I don't know, want to create this world and a repertory company of actors and stuff like that to churn out films. And I think like the destruction of Zoetrope Studios and the ripple effects that had on his career and him personally, you can argue he never recovered from. Like, do you know what I mean? Like the 80s into the 90s, like did some decent stuff, but he's never reached the heights of what he did in the 70s at all.
No, not at all. And I don't see you Christopher Nolans or that, doing their best to try and revitalize or make, help fund and produce the careers of an aging filmmaker now. Like we've lost that level of support even and understanding that we had, with your Coppolas and Scorsese and all of those of their ilk.
Yeah, it's perfect. Well, yeah, but I'm going to slightly change this question because I always feel like, I don't know, based on this film alone, are they the greatest film family of all time?
On this film alone, Okay, taking from the fact that this is the husband of Talia Shire for that period of time, and like listening to that score and its placement and what it does within the film, I'd say yeah. If certainly not the greatest, they're certainly up there. I think like based on the score from somebody who was a family member for a short period of time. Yeah, fuck it. Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. I always feel like asking that question in its original form is just a bit like, because there's so many of them, it feels like it's weighed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh yeah, do you want to fight? It's almost like if it was a fight, do you want to fight a family that's got two members in it, or do you want to fight a family that's got 27 like 1,000 members that the Coppola seem to have? It's like, it seems wholly unfair.
Well, I love the fact we didn't even go into the fact that, you know, the film's director, Joseph Sargent, went on to make Jaws: The Revenge.
Amazing.
I know, right?
What a slap in the face to Robert Shaw. Do you know what I mean? Like oh, I did this amazing film with you. Now I'm going to go like shit on the legacy of that great film you did. Well, it leads me to my final question and... possibly the most important question on this podcast, which is what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
It could be anything. It could literally just a whispered rosebud in her ear. And like, what the fuck? Yeah. Or, this is my address in LA. This is my address. I keep a key under the rock behind the back door. See you there in 3 weeks today. I don't know, something.
I've got a massive paycheck coming in from Garfield.
I'm going to take you around the world. Yeah.
Amazing, Daryl. Well, thank you so much for coming and making
thanks for having me on, man.
Connections, man. Where can people find you and everything you're doing, whether it's the podcast or talking about films in general?
So, yeah, I'm the one lurking behind SDD Film Podcast on Twitter. That's for Sudden Double Deep. And then, obviously, I'm also on Is Paul Dano OK?, which you can find us wherever you're listening to this now, I imagine. our second season's... I think we'll have probably got close to ending by about now. Yeah. So go back and listen to those first two seasons of shows, and season three will be kicking off pretty soon with some pretty high profile film reviewer swanky guests, which is nice, covering There Will Be Blood. Yeah.
Amazing. Again, thank you so much, man, for coming on and chatting about this film.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much again to Daryl Bear for coming and joining me for this rip-roaring, rollicking time around the New York subway system. How do you feel about the new format of asking, based on this film, specifically, if they're the greatest film family of all time? I feel like it makes it a bit more exciting. Feel free to let me know, and you can do that on all these social media platforms, so that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and even Letterboxd at Caged In Pod. Or if you want to drop me something that's a bit more detailed, drop me an email at cagedinpod@gmail.com. As I mentioned in the intro, and I'll mention it here as well, you can support the Patreon, you can support the podcast on Patreon, which is patreon.com/cagedinpod, as well as Ko-fi, and I'll drop the Ko-fi, I never know how it's pronounced. I'll drop the link in the show notes, so you can chuck some money. I understand if you don't want to make the commitment to an ongoing thing. As for next week on the show, I will be joined by Tristan Burrell of the Double Impact podcast. So we had Sudden Double Deep this week, and now next week we've got Double Impact to talk about the John Schwartzman Lens 2014 foray into the Dracula world with Dracula Untold. It's a fun episode. It's maybe an underwhelming film. You'll have to tune in and find out next week. But yeah, I had a lot of fun with this episode, and I'm sure you will as well. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. It all really helps. So as always, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.